Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
This episode of Silent Giants is brought to you by Allie. Allie, powered by Verizon Locations, are developed by Verizon, the world's leading technology company, in collaboration with Allie, a membership-only community workspace for creators. Each location is a community curated powered by the emerging technologies and thought leadership of Verizon. With Allie, Verizon is bridging the gap between startup and corporation by helping the community workspace build next-level ecosystems for entrepreneurs.
And now, on to my interview with Mike Ladman.
But so they're like, you, besides this, you have no portfolio or anything. You have all this music. Why don't you go for the music producer internship? And I was like, What is that?
Yeah, check it out. I'm your host, Corey Cambridge. Everybody tuning in, you invited. No matter what mood you in, get excited. Everybody love the music. Let me tell you how they do it. Whether writer or an agent, let me tell you how they made it. You are now talking to a silent giant. Wanna walk in their shoes, silent giants. Wanna study they move, silent giants. Wanna know what they do, silent giants. Silent giants, y'all.
Welcome to another episode of Silent Giants Podcast, a show that highlights the superstars behind the scenes of popular culture. I'm your host, Corey Cambridge. To keep up with the latest on the show, be sure to follow us on Instagram at Silent Giants Podcast. To keep up with my life, music, and more, be sure to follow me as well at Corey Cambridge. Today's special guest is Mike Ladman, music supervisor at Droga5 Creative Agency. Droga is an agency that works with companies across various mediums of broadcast, print, digital, social, and experimental marketing. Some of Droga5's most recognizable work includes campaigns for the New York Times, Marc Ecko, Newcastle Brown Ale, Android, and Under Armour. I linked up with Mike in his office to chat about his love for music, how he became a music supervisor, and learn more about his day-to-day experience at Droga. So, without further ado, let me introduce you to the music supervisor, my friend, the silent giant, Mike Ladman. That's great.
That's cool.
You sound amazing. What's up, Mike?
Hey, cool.
But this is the most like relaxed interview I probably have ever had.
Yeah.
As far as like, you know what, it's, how does it start? Typically, it's like preparation. We have to like, you know, make sure you're talking to the microphone and you can talk, you know, make sure to talk slower because it's a podcast and blah, blah, blah. It's like preparation. No, this is like, let's eat some cashews. Let's like look at apartments.
There we go. All right. Cashews, apartments, all good.
How's the apartment hunt going?
It's getting there. I think after your help, I think we're going to be in a nice spot because I haven't found someone who gets Brooklyn and I think gets what I'm looking for.
Well, look, your neighborhood is a representation of your personality. Why the neighborhood is important is because your friends are the people who are going to help you, right? Like that's how you figure out if you want to be in finance. If I want to be a finance person, like work on Wall Street, I'm living in Hoboken. Like that's where they are.
Yeah.
That's where they're hanging.
Yeah.
You know, but if I want to get into being a painter, well, I'm going to live on the Lower East Side. I'm going to live in Alphabet City. I'm going to live in Williamsburg. I'm going to live somewhere, or Bushwick. I'm going to live somewhere where artists live. So I think it's a very important element of your personality and where you want to go in your life and your career is who you hang out with.
Yeah.
You know?
It's, yeah. Which when we were chatting last, that was, it was cool because it was, you highlighted some things that I think I thought were wrong with life or not, or just not as planned. And then just in terms of that, of like where you are and who you surround yourself with. Something that I'd been doing, but I don't know if I was doing it necessarily consciously, but noticing that by doing that, or for a while, I think that's what I was right with neighborhood not mattering, was I kind of separated this work and like personal thing for, like it was two different things.
Mm.
And then the longer I've been doing it, just like, especially in the music side of things, like all those people just became like good friends. And once it was just like those sorts of things kept like mixing, that's when I found like, could elevate and have these other chats of really inspiring things like we were talking about. Like, where is music going? Where is advertising going? Where is media content? Like, where am I going in this? What is my role within these worlds and just the world and goodness and all that stuff? So now thinking about it, it's like, all right, I could, like, I saw a great apartment right back in Financial District, but it's like, that's not going to elevate me for where I want to go or be around the people. And it's like, I think Droga, it's like, people are like, why is it on Wall Street? That seems so funny, where it's like, you're walking around, it's like, Wall Street, bro, Wall Street, bro. It's like, flamingo shirt and like crazy hair, like on a bike. That's, it's like Droga, you could spot it. And then, but we're right by the ferry, so it's super easy for Brooklyn to get here.
Yeah.
And I think for so much of my apartment, it's like, well, what allows me money to do other stuff? And then like, what's near a gym? What's near a commute? All this sort of thing that like separating the two. But if it's all together, it makes more sense.
Have you seen the Quincy Jones documentary yet on Netflix?
No, I got that. It's like the number one thing on there. I keep seeing everyone talk about it. I think you were the first one turned me on to it. And it's just been everyone just kind of blowing up since.
Well, it goes back to the point of when you watch a documentary like that, Quincy is always hanging around music or creative people. You know what I mean? Like that's his world. Like he lives his work.
Yeah.
You know, his friends are people that he makes music with. You know, like not just music, but he can create with, whether it's like, yo, we're going to build this television platform, we're going to make Vibe magazine, or we're going to make, you know, the Fresh Prince of Bel-Air. He's always surrounded by work. His work is his friends, are his friendships.
It's, yeah, it makes sense. And that's also, I was just listening to the Tim Ferriss and Rick Rubin thing.
Ooh, I got to hear that.
That was an early one, so I missed that. That was, I was lucky. It was kind of that thing by sort of by kind of just hanging with people and having these conversations. People just start introing me to other people, which just led to, I had an amazing conversation Monday for 2 hours with Zach Cowie, the music supervisor for Master of None, among other things, which I always reference that show as like, this is what, and I think the public noticed too, what great music supervision is and should be, and was such a fan. And we just talked about just everything.
Did you always want to be a music supervisor?
I think like most people growing up, there was like kind of three things everyone wanted to do. Paleontologist, marine biologist, right? Or right, like who, like you, everyone wanted to like dig up dinosaurs. Yeah, like I'm gonna go do this, and I'm gonna go.
The marine biologist is always like the basic Starbucks girl. The girl who likes Starbucks with the yoga mat was like, I want to be a marine biologist. Like, I know what you're gonna be.
Yeah, right. And then
you're gonna be that Starbucks girl.
Yeah, Starbucks girl. Like, but you wanted to be that. I'm gonna hang out with dolphins all day. What a great job, right? I'm gonna be digging up dinosaurs that haven't been dug up. Like, no one's digging up dinosaurs. Or you wanted to pick a movie soundtrack.
Yes,
right?
Yes.
Like everyone had that thought. And so in high school, I remember, because I once I figured out music was my thing, when I was super young, first grade, I was like, I'm going to be a New York Ranger, hockey. And then fifth grade, I picked a guitar and just went, nope, we're going music.
What's the story of you getting your first guitar? What's the story behind that?
I guess the first thing I wanted to do was drums. I saw a drum solo like at a, you know, the school band orchestra, whatever that thing, you know, whatever the show was. I think they did like Green Day. I was like, oh, that's so cool, you know? And I saw drums, so I was like, that looks awesome. I want to do that. And so my parents got me, you know, it was like, they got me drum lessons. And he sat down and gave me a little circle flat drum pad and some sticks. And we started going quarter notes, like, you know, like just hitting. And I was like, this is terrible and boring. Like, where is that? I want to smash a cymbal. I want to be that cool guy. And it was like torture for me to practice. So that lasted a month, maybe. Didn't dig it. And then I heard a guitar solo, which, in a Real Big Fish song, Beer. And I was like, no, that sounds cool. I want to do that. And I was visiting, family friends in Massachusetts, and he had this little Toys R Us, you know, guitar with like a speaker built into it. And he taught me two songs, you know, Smoke on the Water and Wild Thing, which is also Louie, just depends, same song, just different lyrics, but guitar. And like, I was hooked. They're both like, you know, 3-4 note songs, but it was like the most fun thing.
Did you find that like one thing I struggle with the drums versus like guitar or piano is the melody? Did you struggle with the fact there's no melody with the drum? It's just a beat?
I think if I was on a drum kit and could hear the music, I would have maybe liked it more.
Yeah.
But that was it. The guitar was like, I was just hearing just hearing smacks. Like, you know what I mean? The guitar was like, oh, I hear a song. That's what I heard a song. I heard a melody. And so now it's like, also, it's like looking, you know, as you get later in life, it's like, hey, baby, you want to hear me play drums? Like, you know, like play guitar is like, you know, a little bit more swooning to that. Or like, you know, it's also just from a sheer, like, you don't want to lug around a drum kit. My drummer was amazing and he had a rack and like, you have to, it's just such a pain in the ass to lug around drum stuff. It's so annoying. It's not practical. It's like, I love drummers. I think great drummers are usually a little weird. There's like, it's like a goalie in hockey.
Yeah.
Like there's like, you kind of got to be nuts to have like stuff, people shooting pucks at you all day. You kind of got to be nuts to just be smacking shit for hours every day.
Well, it's like, also kind of, it's also an isolated instrument. You know what I mean? Like you are, the goalie is sitting there by himself on the other end of the ice, just kind of just sitting there.
Twiddling thumbs.
And then, when his time comes, he's getting like whacked.
Yeah. Yeah, totally.
And I feel like the drummer's kind of the same way where like they're not playing notes.
Right.
Right. Like the bass player, the guitar player, the piano player are playing notes.
Yeah.
So they're vibing on like a chord structure thing.
Totally.
Versus the drummer is like on a banging thing.
He's in his own world of mechanical, just time. Like,
yeah.
You know what I mean? And like, obviously they can get melodic and do stuff, but usually it's their own kind of.
The drummer is the bartender at the restaurant. The bartender doesn't deal with the food. He makes the drinks.
Yeah.
He's vital. You have to have drinks at the restaurant, but he's not the chef. He's not the server. He's not the busboy. He's not running the food.
Yeah.
He just makes the drinks and he's in his own little world.
Yeah. His own little thing. Keeping it going.
Going with the food references here.
I know. I just didn't want to dispute you because I think the drink thing can get, there's certainly a good mixologist can get into that world of.
Okay. That is true.
Yeah. But for the large majority, like of a normal place of just beer and wine, he's just keeping, yeah.
He's just slinging booze.
He's slinging, yeah.
That fancy drummer is like Phil Collins, you know?
I think I'm going to see again in 2 weeks with... there was a crazy night with Phil Collins and two buddies from McCann and Music, my previous agency. Yeah, there was a whole Phil Collins thing, and I got an invite to... a fortunate invite to go see him again, probably because they didn't know about the last time. And so I think we're going to go try and do a round two, but hopefully a little bit more... a little bit more sober. We're backstage and we're politely, they're very like, oh, I think Phil's done seeing people. Right. And so we never actually met him. We were backstage and we're politely told not allowed to go back and hang with Phil. So maybe this time. This was a while ago. This was like 8 years ago.
Yeah, I gotta make that one happen, dude. It's Phil Collins. So now you discovered the guitar and you wanted to pursue this as a career. As a guitar player.
Yeah. And I feel like I should go back and explain, like, I feel like you don't expect a music nerd to say Real Big Fish and ska is why I play guitar. I really got into this. But my sister was older. So as the young, you know, the baby in the family, younger brother, kind of listened to what, you know, the older sibling listens to. The cool kids. So they were into, like, this was, would have been like 97, maybe something like that. So it was like Blink 182, Dude Ranch came out and like Real Big Fish. Turn the radio off, like all that sort of stuff is what they were listening to. So that's what I was listening to, you know, listen to that stuff. And then that's where I heard that. And so I had like a period where I was going through, you know, the punk rock thing. And then I just had a knack for guitar. And as I got better at guitar, my musical taste changed because I kept trying to find things more challenging on guitar. But I picked up that guitar. And like even in sixth grade and fifth grade, I was waking up early to play guitar before school. And just fell in love with it. And then I was like, well, this is what I'm going to do. I'm going to be a rock star. So seventh grade, I had my first band going, a band, Misfire, very seventh grade kind of thing. And we were great musically, but at that age, I never tried to sing. I still haven't sung. I've only entertained it like within the last year and want to get voice lessons. And I think people keep telling me different teachers. I just got to pick one and go.
Yeah.
But never had a desire to sing. But at seventh grade, it's like, puberty's happening. So like musically, we're great. But like the singers in my band were the three piece. Everyone played an instrument. The drummer and the bassist were amazing musicians. It's just not great singers. Like it was always like, come to the show, just don't listen to vocals. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So then it wasn't until halfway through high school where I kind of had some band changes and kind of started a new band, this band Tunnels to Korea,
okay,
which I still think is a great name for a band. It kind of happened haphazardly. But I only ever thought of being a rock star. I never thought I'd be in an office. Like, no way. I was just going to be on stage. And that was it. But it was around that time where, you know, parents start saying, you know, what, you know, you got to have a fallback or something, or what else can you do in music? And I was like thinking, what else? And, you know, it's like hearing soundtracks to Tarantino and Wes Anderson films. And I was like, that'd be awesome to do that, you know? And so I remember I made a MySpace page just so I can try and reach out to these people. I watched all the credits and then looked up and saw a music supervisor is like the guy who does that. And so I messaged Randy Poster, who does all the Wes Anderson stuff. It's not Susan Jacobs. She's amazing.
And you did this over MySpace?
Yeah, because I didn't know how else to get to these people.
And how old are you at this time?
I mean, this is me and I'm like 14, 15.
Wow.
Like, you know, just like in the middle of high school, kind of around then. And the guy from Entourage, I remember I tried to, he might've been the only one who I could find him. And it was probably like a fake one. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
No one got back to me, of course, but like.
Dude, props to you for having vision so young. I think that's a lot of, you know, people say that, oh, you work really hard or you have such drive. But I think when drive meets vision, you have something powerful. Like, you know what I mean? Yeah. Like the guy who works over, you know, not to, you know, everyone's a hustle's a hustle. But if you're working at the Wendy's and you're flipping the burger at the Wendy's, that guy works hard.
Yeah.
You know I mean, that's hard fucking work.
On your feet all day, dealing with all sorts of crazy people.
Yeah. But to have vision of saying like, you know what? I want that. And that's what success looks like for me. I think is the difference between a lot of folks who make it and don't make it. So props to you.
Thank you. Yeah. It was just like, just new music. What can I do in music? Like, there's got to be some way to do it instead of an office.
Who's the first person to kind of like, you know, reach back, you know, out to you? That you like, you know.
I mean, I was like two, three people. So like no one in that world. That was just like a thing I did and didn't even reflect back on until much later. Like, oh yeah, I kind of did that thing. And it was kind of like, I remember I was always the friend who liked being the one to find the new music and then just give it to all my friends. Like I always loved just sharing great music with people.
Are you with that Kazaa Napster?
I was on with the all CDs. Of that. Like I was on that. I mean, I was in. Yeah, I was on all that, and it's like back then it was like different for finding music. For anyone who showed me new music, I was like, "How do you find new music?" I was like, "What's your rabbit holes and all that?" And I think the number one way to do it was like, you get a CD, and you just read the liner notes, like what do they sound, who are they thanking in their credits and all that, and then. You know, later I learned all music and then you see what's the best album from them and who are they influenced by. And I'm trying to just get whatever I can from these artists who I totally idolize. Like who inspired them? What are they listening to? And then just going there.
Where'd you go to college?
University of Delaware.
Okay. But you're from Jersey?
From Jersey.
Okay.
And never thought I'd go to college. Like just rock star. Like that was all
it. What'd you major in?
Communications, mass communications, yeah, just that, like everyone.
That is like the slacker major. It's like sophisticated slacker. Like, I was a comm major.
It was just like, I don't know, but like, I'm talking. Like,
I'm
like,
talking. Something I'm communicating. Here.
Like,
I like I'll people.
Yeah, I'll figure it out. But if you accept me into your college, it means I communicated well. So I think we got something going on.
Oh, it's one of those things where you sign up for to be a comm major and it sounds nice, and then people are like, "So what do you do?"
Like, it's like,
yeah.
I'm doing it now. This is my thesis right now.
It's like, how'd you become a? What was it? Your first like professional break? Because at this time, you still wanted to be a music supervisor in school.
No, I didn't. I was kind of lost. It was actually really hard to get in the communications program at Delaware. It was they accepted only top 100 students. It was based off four courses, which had like, you know, 300 people apply. So you knew after like course one, it got really competitive. And there's a whole story about how I got into that major that I don't know if I should fully share publicly, but, I ended up getting in. We'll do that maybe off record.
So I was dating the admissions.
It wasn't anything that bad, but there was one extra credit assignment that pushed me into the major. And yeah, it was, yeah.
You know, you use your connects.
Yeah, it wasn't even a connection. It was just a little, we got it. We're here now.
We're here now. That's all that matters.
We're here now. But basically, I guess it would start with that. It was when the band broke up that I was like, I thought I'd go to Rutgers and keep the band together.
Yeah.
The singer left, and then I was like, shit, now I gotta figure out this college thing. Like, for real, take it seriously. Because I thought I'd just do that and band on the side. Because the band was doing well, like over 100 tickets a show. Clubs were calling us. Like, we were starting to get some opening gigs for, you know, decent people, like buzz bands in the area. And then that left us like, oh, shit, I'm back to square one. So I went to Delaware because it looked beautiful. It was these big grassy greens and brick buildings. It's what you think of college.
Yeah.
You know, like, I looked at Berklee School of Music, and it was just kind of had some wacky stats to it. And Northeastern just wasn't feeling it. And I never really liked Rutgers. It felt too close to home. Yeah. And just Delaware looked great.
Out of school, what was your first professional job? And did you know at this point, like, how did advertising come into play? Like,
So that came about. I had no idea. My stepsister was older, and she was an art director.
Okay.
And she told me about that. And I always liked creative and improv and just making things. And so she told me about what that was. And it's like, that kind of sounds cool. I'm like, I'll do weird Skittles commercials or Starburst. Like, I like that weird stuff. I was like, I can make those commercials. And it's like, you know, you get into the office at like 10-ish, dress in t-shirt, jeans, or gold Nikes.
Fresh ass gold Nikes.
Yeah. I like that. It reminded me, it's kind of like my favorite comedian was like Mitch Hedberg. And he had like a joke where I was like, you know, he put out comedy CDs. Like, I dressed up for the CD, and that was kind of my way of doing it. It's like, no one could see.
These are so fresh.
No one could see them, but they're I'm rocking them. But anyway, so she told me about advertising and what it was, and like, you can wear t-shirts and jeans to work, and like, there's drinking in the office, and it sounded kind of fun. So I applied for an internship at McCann Erickson. This is my going into my the internship would have been like going into my senior year of college.
Okay.
As a copywriter. I didn't know how to do Photoshop, but I was like, I could, you know, think and make things. And I went to the interview, and they really liked me. It was this great interview, but they're like, usually copywriters have portfolios and English majors and all this experience, and you work at a record store. You've been in bands. Your email is jhendrix@udel, which was every teacher commented on. I was like, I don't want to be lame Mike Ladman. Like, oh, like, what is there? And then I was like, I was blown away. Like, no one picked Jay Hendrix? Like, how is that possible that no one picked Jay Hendrix for their Udell email? But okay. Jimi Hendrix didn't go to Delaware.
Number one professional advice that, you know, and I didn't know this either
before
I got into the professional world. Your email matters. BballCheck55@Hotmail?
Nah.
Not killing the game.
Yeah, I just saw someone and I was like, or someone had an email. I was like, Hotmail. I was like, how are you gonna get taken serious? Like, you want to get into no.
I feel like Gmail,
yep,
is like the lowest you can go. It has to be your Gmail or your company.
Yeah.
But you can't even bring Yahoo anymore. I don't think.
No, I didn't even. Yeah, like none of that. You can't. You just can't do it. It's like, are you in middle? Like, yeah, you can't do it. Like, version point what? Yeah, that doesn't.
Yeah, so
So they're like, yeah, basically you have no writing experience and are not qualified. Although I did present a really good Swedish Fish commercial. My steps is like, you should make like a mock ad. And so my thing was it's like a 60-second spot, and it was a father and a son walking through a zoo, and the dad thought he was like this hot shot, like he knows about all the animals, and then the son would kind of ask him these outlandish questions of like, you know, can a giraffe be afraid of heights? You know, do fish get thirsty? And the dad gets growingly more frustrated that he doesn't know the answer. Like, no, we're... And then so at the end, it's like, all right, let's just eat. Enough of your questions, son. Let's eat something. And he buys him a bag of Swedish Fish. And the son goes, you know, do Swedish fish eat their own babies? And the dad smiles and laughs and goes, of course they do, son. Of course they do. And it's like, Swedish fish, so good you'd eat your own babies. And that was like my only little ad thing. Which I don't think would go over so well. Eating babies, frowned upon. Yeah,
probably not. But
that
was
the kind of thing ads I thought I would do. It's like, I'm gonna walk in and do weird ads.
Yeah,
not how it works. But so they're like, you. Besides this, you have no portfolio or anything. You have all this music. Why don't you go for the music producer internship? And I was like, what is that? Like, well, you work with our EP. This, like, you know, one of the big guys in advertising, legend, like Mike Boris. Work with him and pick and produce music for commercials. And I was like, you know, it was like an off menu item. I was like, I didn't know that was a job. I didn't know that was like an option or a thing someone got paid to do.
Yeah.
And I was like, let's like, hell yeah, let's do that. Like, that sounds amazing. And so I actually didn't know that I got that over. I got accepted to the internship, but I didn't realize that's what I got accepted for until like day one of the internship. And they were calling out everyone to like go to their creative leaders and whatever their bosses were going to be, that I got the music one. I thought it was a copywriter. And then I was like, oh, this is awesome. And so then I just kind of, I like went all in. I was first one in the office, last to leave. I like finally had an outlet for all this music knowledge. And like, I was like, oh my God, people are sending me music. Like my email is just full of music. And like, I get advances. And I got like, all the big, you know, Elephant Six collectives, like Neutral Milk Hotel and all that stuff. And I got like, music tapes, new album, or the second album before it was out.
And who's sending you this music? Like, is it other music supervisors? Like, who sends you music? Is
labels, artists? Publishers. So everyone who reps the music, who wanted to get stuff into ads, was like, I was starting to get on their mailing list.
Okay.
As the intern, the music intern for Mike Boris, you know, McCann, music department. And it was like kind of right around that time where it was becoming a thing. Like music and commercials, becoming a thing. It was like the Feist Apple commercial came out probably when I was still in college, because I remember that's, but that was a big one. And then like around this time was sort of when like Phoenix 1901 mm-hmm. was in Cadillac, and Justice Genesis was in Cadillac, and Crayola was doing cool stuff with like that unicorns commercial and Animal Collective, and I think there was another cool one they did. And then the Dodos were in like a Miller, I think, commercial. And I was seeing all these indie bands in commercials. Like, this is so cool. And back then, like, indie really meant something. Like, the record stores, you'd have stuff that was like just for indie record stores. And that's, I think, when Pitchfork really mattered. Like, their ratings, if it was best new music or recommended, like, we would stock up on those CDs. Like, because they would fly off the shelves. And so that's like when you had all the kind of indie darlings of like, it was like Grizzly Bear and LCD Sound System and Bon Iver is on his first album. And, you know, Vampire Weekend had their first album. And all these bands like kind of were like, they were huge to us, you know.
Because I had a chance to interview a woman named Mary Wood. She has a company called Frisbee. She was one of the legendary jingle writer, especially like back in the 90s. So she did like Pepsi song with Aretha Franklin, and she also did 7-Up. It's an Up thing. She sang that one too.
Yeah.
But we had a good conversation about the shift that she's seen in the advertising industry. And she was mentioning that back in the day, you know, the a band like Nirvana or, I don't know, Pearl Jam would never.
Yeah. Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
They want their music in an ad ever. But because of the internet and Napster and these streaming sites, now there was a demand where they were like, we can make money off of this. And they started sucking up to the ad agency. Was that something that you experienced as well?
So back then when those things were happening, like, you know, there's original. So for what I do, there's. The easy way to say it, the two kind of bread and butter parts of it. There's a lot more that we do and personally that I look to do rather than just, but you're putting music to picture. So you have a picture, you have a brief, and you're essentially finding and sourcing ways to put music to that. And so the two halves of that are most often licensing, where you're just putting Nirvana or Weezer, whoever it is, Anderson .Paak, you're taking their music, their song as is, and putting it to picture and marrying those two together. The other half is kind of the original composition where you're having, you know, someone like Mary, a music house, or what you think of as a jingle company, create music specifically for picture. And I think the jingle may be sort of coming back more than it had been, but like usually it's not a jingle. Usually it's just a score, what you think a movie score would be for an ad. And now as things have changed, artists more and more are doing that, where I've been, had an insane range of artists, whether it's went file or not, like, you know, write for ads, which is awesome. We had, you know, Panda Bear, you know, a band that I've loved, you know, Animal Collective, who I love forever, scored 6 Uniqlo spots for me. You know, it's like within the first month of Droga, I got to do that. I'm like, this place is awesome. But
they made the music specifically for the Uniqlo ad.
Yeah.
Wow. And, you know, I interviewed a good friend of mine. I didn't interview him. We were having a conversation, and I was like, "Yo, he's a rapper," and I was like, "Yo, fam, how you making all this money? You know what I'm saying? He's living good." I'm like, "Yo, like, we eat in nice restaurants."
Yeah,
and he was like, "Oh, dude, like, I did an ad for Honey Nut Cheerios."
Boom!
Like, that's my voice. And I was like,
"Yeah,
how did?"
That's a cool gig.
And so being able to, I think artists now are realizing, you know what, I can be this entity, this artist, this guitar player, this singer, this rapper, but I can also lend my talents to the corporate world and not have it interfere at all with the brand that I'm building for myself personally.
Yeah. And that's, so I kind of digressed, but so I think you had these indie bands sort of doing it because the ads were kind of cool. Those ads were kind of cool. It's a way to, it's back then it was certainly lesser budgets because of that indie thing, but like, It was a good little paycheck. And so I know the, you know, Of Montreal did an Outback thing where they changed the lyrics to "Let's Go to Outback Tonight," and they caught a lot of heat for it. And he's like, "I've been a struggling artist for 10 years. All this money is going, now I got a paycheck to go make more music and art and have a better stage for you, the fans." And that's kind of where I think it happened, where artists were losing streaming sales and all these other sales, and they saw it as a means of, hey, we can finally get paid and we can record our next album. It's a means to do art. And it's a means to, now it's like it's a way to just get your music out there. It's mutually beneficial. I think there's some places or brands that can be where it's like, hey, maybe you're welcome, look at all these exposure, but it's really mutual beneficial because it's elevating the brand and the spot by having this cool band in there. And I think a big shift was, because it was frowned upon for so long. It was selling out. And a couple of years ago, I was fortunate to go to a small listening session with maybe 10 people and with Moby to hear his new album.
Yeah.
And we just sat down and we talked for like an hour or so, but about, he was really the pioneer in that world. Push Play, that was like, I think the first, or it's one of the only albums ever to have every song synced. And he caught a lot of heat for that. Everyone was like, dude, you sold out and all this stuff. And he looked at it as like, well, now I have money to do art. More people are hearing my music. Like, I don't see the downside to this. He kind of looked at, you know, I think people kind of almost look at it as like Robin Hood. You're kind of taking from these big companies and you're giving it to the bands and the artists. And, you know, he said after a while, he'd have all these bands maybe were hating on him, would come back and be like, how'd you do that? Like, what did you do? How did you do that? Like, how'd you get your stuff? We want to do that. And I think that was a big thing of like kind of changing that shift. And then when indie meant something, it was seen as being cool. And it was like cheap. These small bands, smallish relative bands, you know, compared to the massive A-listers at the time, were seen as indie and cool. And so it was also much cheaper. And now, though, it's funny. It's kind of just having a conversation about how it's flattening out, where there's so much more in indie where you want to break a band, where if they're synced, like, I might not want to go near them because they're already blown up and discovered. I want to be the first to break a band. So those fees are going up because you only have that first sync. So it's kind of a poker game of like, do we want to take this ad or is there a better one coming? You know, it's kind of that sort of thing.
Okay.
And then some of the huge names who didn't license are now like, hey, we're open for business. Like, don't think of us as untouchable. Don't think of us as like, you know, seven figures just to start. Like, we're open to this. So a lot of those big name older dudes who never licensed are like now down to play ball. And like those A-listers, like icons are coming down in price a little bit.
Are these A-listers, are you seeing more of them reaching out to you, them wanting to build more relationships with you?
Totally. It's why I'm thinking this whole little era is kind of like the golden age of, I think, licensing.
Yeah.
Because especially in advertising, where there's still broadcast is still alive, and it's you know, because that's certainly decreasing with, you know, DVR and everything going to Netflix and streaming, but it still is that big thing where Big Sync can make an artist. And so now you're noticing there's a lot of these amazing listening events where labels and publishers are like kind of hosting these small intimate things with these icons, essentially, to kind of say, hey, we're open, instead of just doing an email. It's like, here, you'll get to meet this person or whatever it is. And so like, it's those sort of conversations where they're smart and kind of, you know, courting, I think, the music supervisors in a way that, yeah, like you can't say no to hanging out with, you know, whoever it is.
Yeah, because I would imagine you're in the position now almost like being the, you know, the playlist curator over at Spotify or Apple. You know what I mean? As far as like, hey, I have the ability and the power to say, look, I can put you in that Skittles ad.
Yeah, it's that. And it's obviously, you know, it's kind of a gauntlet of approvals within an agency or anywhere to just be like, here's a song, go and get it in there. But there kind of is that. And it's really interesting you say that, because I was just, you know, talking about friends and all this stuff. I got connected to this guy, just, I'm curious about Spotify playlisting. Like, how does that work? And through a manager connected me, I'm trying to think who, someone connected me to this great guy, you know, John at Spotify, who does all the playlists.
Yeah.
For like a lot of the indie stuff, and just talking to him and just chatting. Like, there was no agenda. Like, you know, I just wanted to know how he did what he did, and what is that like, and how does he listen to music, and how does he view music, and kind of learning that. And if you kind of really distill the music and the majority of how people get music and the curators of that music, it's really a couple hundred people in the world probably that are really giving the music world, between all the music supervisors and the playlisters. It's a small group who are really kind of not seen. It's only recently, I think, where the name music supervisor and that job is a thing, where now there's courses on it. And there's, I was just chatting yesterday, and there's a great, you know, movement now by the Music Supervisors Guild. These guys made this guild to kind of help bring awareness and to get it to the forefront. So it's gonna be the first ever New York ad event next Friday.
Okay.
Which will be great. And so I'm doing a panel for the ESPN rebrand we did with Creative and, you know, some of the guy at ESPN, Kevin Wilson and Jonathan Hecht, talking about how we do that. But it's music and film and everything. And there's that idea of like, hey, like everyone's, you know, there's all these other things that are getting credit for film and all that stuff and TV. But what about the guys giving people music?
And so you're now, you know,
I don't know where we went. I don't know what we talked about, because I know we talked and weren't trying to repeat ourselves.
Well, you're doing music supervision over here at Droga.
So yeah, so fast forward, I had McCann, that music internship. They ended up hiring me upon graduation.
Yeah,
I traveled. I did Birthright, and then I studied abroad in Australia. And I sent every producer every time I traveled, like a keychain or something to keep on their desk, a personalized note. And someone keep on their desk so they'd remember me. And so that when I graduated, hopefully I can get a job. And I kind of held out and put all my eggs in that basket. And fortunately, it worked out. But I was there and started off as a production coordinator, music guy. That was a foot in the door, and was doing expenses and travel for like 8 producers, and like hated doing all that. And it's probably why I'm such a jerk at doing my own expenses, is having to do everyone else's. But did that, and then, you know, was learning music on the side, and then worked my way up at McCann, and had the privilege of working under Mike Boris and Peter Gannon and Eric Johnson, and just learned different things that kind of rounded me out. They all have their own way of working that rounded me out to kind of be ready where I remember day one of my internship was like, I want to be Mike Boris. I want to run a music department. I want to be like the guy that everyone's after and is kind of leading the charge. And so after almost 7 years there, I heard that Droga5 was looking for, is going to start a music department. And Droga5 was the cool, hot agency. They won agency of the year every year. They did the Michael Phelps spot and were just doing all the cool things. And after, I don't get stressed. Like, you know what I'm saying? It's a calm interview. Like, I'm very into like the gym and health. And that's kind of, Tim Ferriss would say, like biohacking or life hacking. That gives me, I think, an edge. It's like, if you feel good and your mind's good, advertising is a crazy world and like really intense. And like, if you're calm, that energy goes out and all around, and I think helps allow better music decisions. If they're frantic and you're like, come in, there's cool vibes of a piano and like, you know, little toys in here, that helps get people in the mode for music to chill. That allows you to kind of just chill and do your thing.
You know, so, you know, everybody wants to, you know, looks at music supervision and they're hearing you speak and they're like, this is the flyest job ever. But what about your job is challenging or sucks or stresses you out? It keeps you up at night.
Yeah, so I think there's two things. One is that I'm very competitive to always and like have high standards for like myself and my ear and for what I think the best music is for a spot. So making sure that everything that goes out is of that quality. And so I really push that every search is awesome, and I'll get really kind of down on myself if I get a brief from my creatives or whoever and like I don't have the perfect song and I search. And so I'll stay up at night like just racking my brain. What is that song? I can't turn it off. Like turning that off when there's something I'm really excited about and I just know there's something better out there. There is that magical song. So I think that is tough and will keep me up. And it's something I probably push on myself that everything has to be like the best spot. And then the fact that music is so subjective and it's kind of a gauntlet of approvals to get a song through. And so the way that works is basically my creatives will give me a brief, right? We have an ad and we need a song about pushing yourself and never giving up, whatever that lyric brief or a vibe, whatever it is. Or sometimes they don't know and they're just like, what do you think works? Here's film, go. And I found I've had the most success where I always look at the brief, but I also just look at the film and I'll answer the brief always, but then I'll also just be like, what do I think is great? And I'll go off brief and give like some weird, dark, kind of dark horses, wild card tracks. And then if you have one of those tracks where there's magic in it, convincing everyone else that that's the track, because everyone goes in and they want this one thing. It's like, you know, I used to not like pickles and now I do. Or
yeah,
they're all right, but olives, I hated olives. I hated olives. I couldn't like I couldn't like eat one and play it cool and be like, no thank you, I don't care for this flavor. I was like, yucky face, like I hated them. And I just kept eating it and kept eating it and kept eating it, and then knew what to expect, and now I loved it. So like, to try and convince people to do it and like to convince people from different tastes and everywhere to like something, because it's just it's subjective. Everyone has an opinion or can think they're a music expert. And so, you know, you can have two British dudes and two German dudes and like a middle-aged dude, and then just internally, and then it goes to client and they have to like it, and it moves up that chain. So I think what's so amazing, one of the amazing things about Droga, is the ability to upsell. So if we don't have a budget to license and it's a smaller budget just to do a score, original score, they'll be like, that's cool, but here's this other thing. And to get everyone to align on one song as this is the best, especially if it's a bold choice. And I think we're really good at pushing that of like, here's what you wanted, but here's the thing you didn't ask for and it's better. And so like, here's five other ads that are doing this sound right now, the blues rock. We don't want to do that. Here's something you haven't heard. And it's scary, but it's much more satisfying. That's what breaks through, is when you're doing something different than just doing the latest reference sound of what whoever else did.
An idea popped in my head while you were speaking. Would it be beneficial for advertisers to have in-house producers, or is that like a thing that exists? Like, let's say, for instance, for a score, if you were doing, if this was Motown back in the 1960s, they had their own band inside to play the Temptations records, the Jackson 5 records, the Marvin Gaye records. Is there a value in having an in-house production musical team to make those scores?
I think it would kind of be, it's interesting because people have pitched that. I think it would be a conflict of interest and kind of limiting us creatively a little bit. The cool thing about McCann Erickson, so my last agency, that was, they were the first ad agency to ever hire a music producer. And there's this guy, Billy Davis, who was from the Motown thing. And he did I Want to Teach the World to Sing and all these really iconic things. And so that was really forward thinking on their part. But to do that and just have one guy, I think it would limit because there's so many different music houses. There's so many different composers. And I always, to my food analogies, which have been pretty minimal in this one, I think, compared to normal. there's a lot of music houses out there. It's a somewhat crowded marketplace with a lot of talented people. And so I think the old school way of doing it is like you have a place where they can do everything. They have all these in-house composers and that's all they do. They make ads and they just kind of pump it out and it works and it's great. And I think there's a sound to that and it works for things. But I kind of say, like, I kind of push everyone to a corner. I'm like, what do you do that no one else can do? What do you do better? Like, what excites you? Because usually the people that started these companies can have interesting backgrounds. They're from a band. They came from here. And you're seeing, what we were saying earlier, a lot of artists really want to write for ads because it's a really challenging, fun, creative exercise. It's, again, a good payday. And they can either do it with their name and likeness attached or anonymously. And they just get to do it. And it's fun and it's money. And it funds whatever and does that. But I'm like, what do you do that no one else can do? And then I kind of put that flagship in the ground. All right, these guys are the modern classical guys. And by doing that, I think it's, you know, you can go to a diner like the old school way and you can get a lasagna and an omelet, but they're going to be all right. But you go to the meatball shop and you get meatballs. Like, that's the thing. Like, I want who does this the best. Like, I want the best for everything. Mm. And so I think there's some benefits for, I think, internal and smaller jobs, or maybe that would make sense. But it's also, I feel like, kind of maybe that Robin Hood of like, how can we share this money with artists? I feel like it's kind of my job to try and spread that pot around to as many people as possible. And I think there's certain places like I call more than others, but it's a meritocracy. Like I try to give everyone a shot as best as anyone can with so many companies. But I think the music kind of can speak for itself. So everyone, if you've won 10 jobs for me or we haven't worked together, probably gonna have to do like some polls and some work to like the same thing you're gonna have to do every time to get in. And if the music's good, we'll go there. And that's, even if it doesn't win, because it can be competitive or have two music houses compete. If it doesn't win, but the tracks are great, I'm gonna call you again. You know what I mean? So it's, and I think now surrounding yourself with good people is such a thing. I want to work with people who like are friends, who have my back, you know, not just trying to get a paycheck, but those people are like, they know that this seat, it's like a tough seat and things change. And it's like, all right, we can collaborate. You'll help me. I'll try and, if it doesn't go your way, like I'll try and get you in on the next job. And it's those people who are good people. They're who you want to work with. They're like, it's everyone wins, you know?
Yeah. You know, to wrap up the interview, I always ask the same question to my guests. And, you know, everyone is on this pursuit of greatness. And I've been blessed to have, you know, almost 50 episodes of amazing, great people who have done inspiring work, who are pushing culture, who have shifted culture. And I know that that comes with a lot of sacrifice. Like, what have you sacrificed to be great at what you do?
That's a good question. It's funny. You know, actually, I guess I was just talking about it kind of last night, actually. I feel like I've kind of, so I was saying, like, I get obsessive. I was obsessive for guitar. I'm obsessive with music. I've been obsessive with this like whole keto intermittent fasting health thing right now. And I think it's like, and more so now, like with our chat and just surrounding myself with good people and having conversations that we had and are having now, more and more to figure out, where is music going? Where is advertising going? Where is content going? How can this help artists? How does it help me? How does it help the world? I was fortunate to go on this incredible music influencer trip in Israel by the Schusterman organization called Reality. They do 10 trips a year, so it's a music one. Like, completely life-changing with the most incredible diverse range of people. And I think what they want you to walk away with is, how can we use our positions to kind of help the world a little bit? And so I think I've been wrapping myself in this world where, you know, I have a beautiful niece in Hoboken and one and a nephew in Central Jersey. And I think what I've sacrificed with that and I'm on is like, I'm just so wrapped up in this world and trying to figure out what the next level of greatness is, that maybe I've sacrificed some time with some like amazing friends and family, which I want to be a part of, be more in. Like, I'm going home to do it. All my best friends from childhood, we're doing a Color Wars. So just a ton of stupid competitive activities. And like, there's every time I look at my phone, there's like 70 texts about what's our team name, what's our color, and smack talking and gifts. And I'm like, I feel like I haven't been as into that because I'm so into making sure everything comes out here is great. Because I kind of take it personally. If music's going out the door, that's like my name. That's like my credit and reputation that I think I've built well over the past, you know, almost decade. And so I think I guess friends and family, I'm so wrapped up in, I think, really trying to greatness and kind of pushing as far as I can this music supervision thing and getting music in the world for artists to be paid and great music to be heard and appreciated, because there's so much stuff that's like, it's a very throwaway culture right now, and trying to figure out how to change it and be a part of it for the benefit of music and content and artists. And then also myself, how can I elevate that and do it in a way that benefits the artists and kind of the world? Is there, you know, it sounds a little kumbaya crunchiness, but it's that. And also dating. It's like, it should be such a good line. You know, I'm a music producer, music supervisor. And that's what I did in the beginning when I had, you know, was making not much money. It was like, the big perk is I can go to any concert for the most part on guest list, which is like, holy shit, that blew my mind. When I, like, I was thanking everyone and they're like, no, thank you for going. And I was like, no, thank you for letting, you know, and like those experiences. And I don't think I've made time for that at all. And like, it's like, you know, for dating, for that whole thing where it's like, you know, hey, what are you doing in 2 weeks isn't really a good line to keep interest. So I guess it'd be some personal stuff.
Well, Mike, thank you so much for being on the show, brother.
Thank you.
Cool ass dude, bro. It's been a love.
I still don't know if anyone will know what music supervision is after this, but hopefully.
Oh, they have a great, great idea. Thank you so much. And shout out to Kat Matt too for making this possible.
Kat Matt, I just hung with her yesterday. We had a beautiful lunch and it was a great hang. Cool. Yeah.
Hey, you're the man.
You're the man.
We out. Thank you all so much for tuning in to another episode of Silent Giants. And to our special guest, music supervisor, Mike Ladman. This episode was mixed by Mark Bird. And before we get out of here, be sure to check out my other show, OPP. Other People's Podcast is a show that highlights my favorite podcasters and the dope shows they created. You can find the link to that podcast in the description of this episode. I'm your host, Corey Cambridge, signing off. Till next time.
Hey, folks, I'm Mark Maron from the WTF Podcast, and this episode is brought to you by Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues, your ally to help tackle your allergy symptoms this season. I love the change of seasons, but nobody loves pollen and all those other things floating in the air that make you sneeze during this nice weather. Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues are hypoallergenic and allergist approved. So fight back against watery eyes and runny noses without worrying about irritating your skin. For this allergy season, grab Kleenex and face allergies head on.